is the fall line. Author and historian Hallie Rubenhold is asking audiences to question almost everything we think we know about one of the most famous unsolved cases in history, the series of late 19th century murders credited to an unknown serial killer, known as Jack the Ripper. Over the many years that Jack the Ripper and his crimes have been studied, a number of other writers and researchers and filmmakers have asserted that their projects are focused on the five women canonically considered to be the victims, and yet, until the release of Hallie's book, The Five, in 2019, little was known about any of the victims' lives. And what's more, based on what Hallie Rubenhold has found, it turns out that what we thought we knew about these women has been surmised on thin evidence at best. Thousands of hours, and who knows how many resources, have been spent trying to identify the killer or killers who we've come to know as Jack the Ripper. But in her work, Hallie Rubenhold has taken a different path, an assertion that, perhaps, trying to identify Jack the Ripper will not answer our questions or solve our problems. Because much as in the case of Samuel Little, it's not so much about the killer as it is about the victims, how they were portrayed, the thin line they walked between housing insecurity and outright homelessness, and the bleak structures of Victorian society that limited their freedoms and dictated their actions. It made the margins wide and the pedestals very high and very narrow. In her new podcast, Bad Women, The Ripper Retold, Hallie builds on the themes of her book, The Five, which is the first deep dive into the lives of the women who were murdered. She explores their entire lives, and not just their movements on the day they died, and also takes on the controversy that follows her work, and her insistence on correcting misperceptions, falsehoods, and tackling victim blaming in true crime. A key theme in Hallie's work comes through when she shows that there is no evidence that three of the five victims were, as has always been assumed, sex workers. In uncovering this, she's not valuing the women any differently, but rather highlighting how little, even given over a century, we've bothered to learn about them. We've been fans of Hallie's work since reading The Five, and felt her new series connects directly to our own work, covering the victims of Samuel Little. So we think you'll find this conversation as interesting as we did. We began by discussing the obsession with Jack the Ripper's identity, and how that obsession can crowd out any real exploration into his victims' lives, as working class and poor women living in England in the late 19th century. Sometimes that obsession takes the form of a preoccupation with so-called evidence in the case, and whether modern technology might be used to analyze objects, and thus identify Jack the Ripper. In one particular example discussed in Bad Women, it's a shawl found near the body of one of the victims, Catherine Eddowes. Thanks so much for joining us for this interview. As soon as I read The Five and heard that Pushkin planned to release Bad Women, I knew that I wanted to interview you. Your interest in foregrounding the victims of Jack the Ripper and backgrounding the perpetrator, making him a ghost in a story that had been his, really aligned with our own coverage of the victims of Samuel Little. I know that you've said that we'll never know who Jack the Ripper is, and our energies, in terms of this case, are better spent elsewhere. In Bad Women, you illustrated that so well through the story of the infamous shawl that so many books and documentaries have focused on, that shawl that is alleged to have belonged to Catherine Eddowes. I bet some of our listeners have heard about that piece of evidence before. What does that shawl represent for you in terms of the absolute wrong approach to the Ripper cases?
Well, it represents just that. It represents the absolutely wrong approach to the Ripper case in so many ways. Not only is the science wrong in that particular DNA experiment on the shawl, And we know there was an error in the white paper. And forensic scientists have come out and actually said that as well. I'm looking at this also from my background as a museum curator and as a historian. And one of the things that is very obviously missing from this shawl is an absolute provenance. Now, in order to identify objects positively, one of the things we need is a very clear paper trail. We need to know that the object was what it's being asserted as. So some story that somebody took a shawl from a murder scene and kept it in their family is not a provenance that would carry any water at all, certainly amongst curators, amongst auction houses. It simply doesn't hold water. You need a paper trail. And again, that's one of the problems for most of the inquiries that have been undertaken into the Ripper case. The paperwork isn't there. The documentation isn't there. And what steps into the breach is mythology and layer upon layer of mythology as well. And we have to cut through that. And it's that mythology that keeps the Ripper alive and keeps the victims sidelined. Another thing which is notably absent is there is nothing actually which ties this shawl to Catherine Eddowes at all. And not only that, it's highly improbable that Catherine Eddowes, who had pawned everything, who was living hand to mouth, would have even owned a shawl that was this nice at the time of her death. It's so incredibly improbable. But it also goes to show how little investigation had actually been done into her life for people just to swallow this, because it is so improbable.
You took an entirely different approach to this case, victim-centered and so deeply researched that you've been able to construct incredibly rich narrative stories for five women who have historically been little more than dissection sketches. And it's especially evident when I listen to Bad Women and hear these stories spoken out loud. Can you talk to us about how you approached your research? Where did you find the information on the five women? And how did you disprove some of the assumptions that have been made for so long?
There are so many myths here that need to be disproven. First of all, there are the myths of the women and their lives and who they were. But there's also the myth of historiography and records of the poor. And this idea that I, as a historian, was even taught when I started my postgraduate degree. And that's that we cannot tell the lives of the poor and the dispossessed because they were largely illiterate and they didn't leave records. Well, that's categorically untrue because, especially now with the massive digitization projects that have been underway, we've been able to really salvage the lives of people who've been otherwise written out of history and completely marginalized. So obviously the poor, and these five women fall into that. So you are now able to do much more detailed research into these women's lives than you would have perhaps in the past 20 years earlier. That's not to say that the information wasn't there and you still couldn't do it. It's just that it's a little bit easier now. So I used a variety of records, everything from census records to birth and death records, marriage records, social housing records, workhouse records were incredibly useful, and a number of other things. And of course, there was a lot of newspaper coverage. Using newspapers, one has to be very, very careful because you have to take everything with a pinch of salt. And if you can cross-reference a lot of this stuff with actual hard records, you can create a sort of imprint of what would be likely in somebody's life. So you know, what somebody says and what appears in a newspaper isn't necessarily a great representation of what happened, but it can give you some sense of what happened. And then you go away and you look at other things and you can balance that out and you can get a sense. One of the things I was very cautious about doing when I was writing the five is in many cases making absolute statements. There are a group of people who call themselves ripperologists who largely have been the ones writing the books. And I think the problem is there are too many attempts to try to say X is a fact and Y is a fact. And we simply can't do that, which is why even with these women's lives, when we actually know much more than we will ever know about who the killer is, you have to be careful in your choice of words. You can draw a sort of outline of a woman's life because you can find all of these kind of pegs to stick in, and then you have to create a shape around that. So you have, for example, you know, when somebody was born, you know where they lived, you know what sort of work they were involved in, you know the type of person they married, you know where they lived. And for working class women, there were very few options. And so you layer this type of information, which is for the most part factual. And, you know, we always question documents as well. You know, there are problems still with census documents, you know, that say somebody's name was this when it wasn't necessarily, and somebody was, you know, 15 when actually they were 17 or something like that. But you get these kind of more fixed points. And then you layer on the experiences of what we know about Victorian women at that time. Like, what were Victorian women's experiences, for example, giving birth in a workhouse in the 1860s? What were Victorian women's experiences of working in a laundry, for example, or working in domestic service, or being the child of a man in the army? And we can kind of fill in the blanks this way. And this is also what a lot of archaeologists do when they're excavating ruins, when they're pulling artifacts out of the ground. You know, you may not have all of the pieces of an urn that you've uncovered, but there will have been another one from that same time period, or maybe even in the same area, which will look similarly. And you can compare it and you can see, that blank bit there, it's likely that another piece fit in that looked like this. It's likely that this was used for that. We can do that with lives also. We don't need every single little detail. We can compare it to other people's lives and other people who had very similar experiences. And that gives us a very broad picture of a person's life.
So you just mentioned ripperologists. One thing I learned from listening to Bad Women, the podcast, that I hadn't learned from reading The Five was the very negative reaction you receive from some of the amateur expert community. And from what you've shared, I understand that some of that perceived offense is that you didn't consult them or that you questioned the sources they treated as established and true. But I had to wonder as I was listening, how much of that upset is coming from your reframing the core of the Jack the Ripper story, that Jack the Ripper preyed on sex workers who were at work when they were murdered. It's interesting because in many fields, what you found, a wealth of new information, that would be celebrated. In your opinion, why is your challenge to that assumption so upsetting to the Ripper establishment?
I think there are lots of reasons, and I think a lot of these reasons are very personal to the people who are doing the attacking, the trolling, the harassment that I have experienced, and it is really vicious. And a lot of it is a sense of ownership of this material, and that I'm an outsider, and it's a case of how dare she come in and do this stuff, and she doesn't know everything we know about it, and we've been looking at these women for years, and this kind of ownership of the material, which I find is really strange. But also because I think for a lot of these people, being a ripperologist is a form of identity. And it's an attack. They see it as a very personal attack on their individual identities. And there's a fear that I'm taking the narrative away from them. I've seen people say, oh, well, she's going to be the expert now. And, you know, they're worried about this. I mean, they were worried about this. 8-9 months before the book came out, I was getting trolled. I was being told that I need to show my evidence immediately to them. And if I didn't, I was being unprofessional. This is 8 or 9 months before my book came out, that I wasn't allowed to say that I had found that 3 of the 5 women weren't active in sex work at the time that they were murdered without having it approved through them. I mean, it's just absurd. So they're highly protective of this material. I think it is about wrestling the narrative away from them. There seems to be a kind of misapprehension here about what an argument is in a book and what a book actually does, what scholarship does. You do a literature survey, you look at what is useful and what isn't useful. You look at where the problems lie in the previous body of literature on the subject. You also analyze what primary sources are there and what does and doesn't work. And unfortunately, looking at most of the documentation that underpins the Ripper story, there ain't a lot of stuff that really holds water. You know, witness statements. There are lots of people who come forward and go, well, I heard somebody say this, and I saw a woman speaking to a man, and I'm sure it was Catherine Eddowes, or I'm sure it was Annie Chapman. These people didn't know that. And what we know, for example, about witness statements today, I mean, in Bad Women, we had a judge look at these witness statements, and he did everything he could possibly do to stop himself from laughing at the absurdity of this being called factual. It's not factual. We know too much now to call it factual. The same can be said about, you know, summaries that appear in documents about things like, there was a summary of William Nichols, who was Polly Nichols' husband, saying she'd lived the life of a prostitute. Well, this was a summary that had been written up after an interview by a member of the police. And everything else is contrary to that. We know where Polly was. We know how she was living. And the concept of living a life of a prostitute is a very, very broad brush, because any woman who lived outside of marriage with another man was living a life of prostitution. That's how the Victorian era thought of women. And if you're living with a succession of men, or, you know, you're living in a number of monogamous relationships, even outside of marriage, you're living the life of a prostitute. And I think there is a genuine fear that in my questioning this, if I keep questioning the veracity of this material, the value of it, that pretty soon they're going to be left with nothing, and then there's not going to be any story, and this then basically undermines everything that's ever been written, and it's an existential threat.
It just strikes me as so strange, because what you're doing is not taking away, you're instead providing all this new material and also bringing in new experts to add nuance to that material. It was episode 6 of Bad Women when you were discussing the Gentlemen of the Press, and you had an expert in Victorian media come on to talk about how the victims were described in the media, the phrases that were used, the veracity of the quotes that were provided, and how seriously we should take them. And I found that framing not only fascinating, but really, really illuminating. And also, previous to that, you had someone discuss police reports. I believe that also came up in the 5, and how we should treat the language in those reports and how that language was applied and how it could be applied to women and how women could be, how it could be used punitively. Like, I believe you tell a story in the 5 about a dressmaker's assistant who was looking in a window shopping and was arrested for prostitution at one point. And just those kinds of stories that you share, to me, that adds to the wealth of knowledge. In scholarship, we assume good faith, usually, you know? The idea of the exchange of information that can only build on something. Because I can't imagine what adding more information could possibly affect its outcome in a negative way. It kind of blows my mind and, if you'll excuse me for saying so, has a pretty heavy undercurrent of misogyny.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, you've definitely picked up on the misogyny. You're dedicating your time to studying the ultimate misogynist, Jack the Ripper. You know, your interest is in a killer of women. The time that is spent engaging with the subject matter is generally in investigating. And all you have to do is look on the forum sites and scroll through the section on the victims. You know, the time that's dedicated to a study of these women often involves, almost always involves, some discussion of their wounds, of how they were killed, the way in which they were killed, where they were when they were killed, the hours before their deaths. And actually, the Ripperologist has been very angry that in writing the book, in telling the narrative the way I have, that I have not included this. It's almost a canon in itself, the stories, you know, the kind of minute by minute, hour by hour accounts of where all these women were prior to the moment of their death, because they seem to see this as part of a life story. I don't see that as a life story. That's a death story. That doesn't tell us who they were as people. It is a constant recounting of the steps towards death. And that does not make them important. It does not make them interesting, necessarily. They're full years of life out in the world, having experiences, living in a Victorian world, to me, make their lives interesting.
I think that a lot of people, when they claim to say that they're doing something for victims, what they're really talking about is they're focusing on how a victim died, sometimes blow by blow. And I think in your project, you made it very clear you're focusing on the fullness of a victim's life. And when you especially talk about whether or not a victim was involved in sex work, I hope people get this point. You don't care if a victim was involved in sex work or not. Your point was simply that women's lives weren't investigated fully. That was the point. And you made this incredibly good point on Twitter earlier this month. I'm just going to read what you wrote. You wrote that two of the Ripper's victims were or had been sex workers. Documentation and the balance of evidence attest to this. They didn't deserve to be murdered. There's no reliable evidence that three of the victims had ever worked in the sex trade. They didn't deserve to be murdered either. There is only one reason why, quote, prostitution has come to play such an enormous role in the Ripper narrative. That's about stigma. The Victorians told a story that worked for them. Women on the street at night alone were prostitutes, and see what happened to them. One really illuminating thing I learned from reading The Five, and that I cannot wait to hear you discuss on the podcast, is how the assumption of sex work was used to control and punish women. Can you talk about your research in that area and how it reframed the stories of all of the women you studied?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously, it varies with each woman. Each woman, I make a very clear point of trying to demonstrate that all five of these women had very unique lives and very unique experiences, as does every person who has ever lived and died. Nobody has the same life or the same experience. And all of those lives are worthwhile. And it doesn't matter what you've done. It doesn't matter what sort of work you've been engaged in. And, you know, some of these women were involved in sex work. And some of these women, the balance of evidence suggests they were not. It's totally, totally irrelevant. I have been accused, I mean, and by people who simply want to take issue with me, that somehow what I'm trying to do is to save these women by prettifying their lives and making it look like they weren't sex workers and hiding the evidence that they were. There's no hiding of evidence going on here. If you interrogate that evidence within the context of what we know about the Victorian era and about the way women were viewed and about morality and about the patterns of sex work, the so-called evidence just doesn't add up. It does in the case of Elizabeth Stride and Mary Jane Kelly. There is enough of a paper trail to suggest that these women were actively involved in sex work. But again, it doesn't matter. The Victorian era wanted to stigmatize women who were involved in sex work. And anybody who suggests that we have overcome these prejudices today, I mean, look again. Look at the victims of Samuel Little. Look at how all of this goes under the radar, how people don't care about the marginalized when the marginalized are killed. And it is, you know, it's incredibly important that we move beyond this. In the 19th century, the moment a woman had sex outside of marriage, she was considered basically unclean, sullied. A woman was meant to be a wife and a mother and a daughter and a carer. That was her primary role in life, to be obedient, to be good, to be the angel in the house, no matter what class she was in. That was her job, to serve men. And a woman could not be trusted if she was not sexually pure. And so society was geared around punishing that and trying to ensure that women stayed within this prescribed role. In the UK, we had the Contagious Diseases Act, which meant that if a woman stepped out of line, if she was living out of wedlock with a man, if it was even suspected that she was involved in prostitution in various port cities in England, she could be picked up by the police, accused of being a prostitute. She would have to be examined to make sure she didn't have syphilis. This legislation was also in effect throughout continental Europe as well. And Elizabeth Stride, who was the third victim, got caught up in this in Sweden as well. And she was stigmatized for the rest of her life, in addition to catching syphilis. And it was terrible. It was incredibly punitive. And, you know, we have yet really to shrug off the mantle of this stigma today.
What do you think is another of the most fundamental misunderstandings about these five women or this case that your work seeks to correct?
That's such a good question. I think we have a very rose-tinted view of the past. I think a lot of us know that the past was very bad and very difficult for women, but I don't think we really have any visceral sense of how bad it actually was for our ancestors. And I think Hollywood has a lot to answer for, because I think when we look at period dramas, we tend to see, oh, it was so nice and men were so good to women in the past and they all wore beautiful dresses. And, you know, this kind of view, at least in the United States, of like something like Little Women, you know, genteel poverty if they were poor. Or sometimes you'll have television programs which will dramatize like The Alienist or something like that, which will dramatize how bad it was in New York and how the poor lived. But again, even that is really romanticized. And I think one of the things I really wanted to show up was exactly how difficult it was to have been alive, not just as a woman, but as a man as well, but also how much a part of life misogyny was in the 19th century. And women couldn't even enter the professions. I think one of the things that people tend to forget or don't really notice or not really aware of is the degree to which misogyny really, really dictated life in the 19th century. So that women didn't have the opportunities, especially the poorer you were, the worse off your life prospects were as well. I mean, there was almost no way out of poverty if you were a woman born into poverty, other than to work your way up through domestic service, to become a maid, and then work your way up through literally like grueling, backbreaking work, all hours, working your way up into the upper echelons of the servant class and then retiring with a little bit of money put aside. It was very, very hard for a woman to get out of that poverty. And we don't really know about that. We don't really recognize that.
Our discussion with Hallie also touched on some overlapping societal inequities faced by both the victims of Samuel Little and of Jack the Ripper. Hallie's research concerned white women, all British or possibly Irish, except for Elizabeth Stride, who immigrated from Sweden. The majority of the victims of Samuel Little were Black women and American. Though a century or more separated their murders, the public's perception of and the lack of sustained attention in the women who lived and died in the margins, that was a key commonality. When we covered Samuel Little's victims, we focused on a comment that Little made, and the gist of that comment is that he killed women on the margins because no one would care about those women. No one would look for them, and we found out that he was incredibly wrong. As we researched and spoke to loved ones, it was very clear that many families had been searching, sometimes for decades. They were just unsuccessful in solving their loved one's murder. The parallel in the cases that you studied seemed to lie in that same marginalization. Obviously, Jack the Ripper's crimes got plenty of press, but his victims didn't, not in a meaningful way. Do you think that a reframing of the media's presentation of the murders at that time could have had any effect on the cases, whether they were solved or maybe on society?
I think to ask that of Victorian society would, I think, be impossible. It's asking Victorian society to step out of itself and out of its conventions and its ideologies and to become victim-centric when there's absolutely no way that Victorian society would ever do something like that. You know, they developed their own narrative for why these women died. And yes, of course, there was the concession. It was tragic. I mean, a murder is always terrible and tragic. But there was also some sense that it was almost an inevitability given the fact that the narrative that Jack the Ripper killed prostitutes was something which served society. It served to reinforce social norms. So they would never step out of themselves and investigate these women's lives more closely. You know, there were times when I got very frustrated when I was doing my research. And I thought, this is so annoying. If only they'd interviewed this person, if only they'd asked this question, if only they'd done this. But they didn't. They weren't interested. The objective was simply to find the killer. And whatever the collateral damage was, and in this case it was people, ultimately, yes, that was sad, but the most important thing was we find the killer, and that is how we can benefit society. And of course, that was never done. And so the case just kind of sat there, and into the void rushed lots of armchair detectives who have been trying really since 1888 to solve this case and have failed. And my feeling is we will never, ever solve this case. We will never do it simply because you have to understand how evidence works. It has to stand up to scrutiny today. And the more we understand about the law and how it works and how useful evidence is, the less likely we are able to do that. The other thing is, people think that they can use science to unpick any mystery. And really, in the case of the Ripper, I mean, I just really can't see this happening. Turi King, who I have worked with on the podcast, who is a very highly regarded forensic anthropologist at the University of Leicester, you know, she says it's extremely unlikely we will find any untainted DNA today. And even so, there are so many possible candidates for Jack the Ripper. You know, so science isn't going to show us a way out of this either. It's just a complete waste of time. However, the one thing that we can do is we can remember the victims. But I think as you mentioned, there is a real investment in being the person who solves the crime, who solves the mystery, and, you know, garners all sorts of fame as a result of this. And that's, I think, what motivates a lot of people. They want to be the person who finally cracks the case. I just can't see that happening.
One thing that struck me in both the podcast and the book was an issue that is still prevalent today: the practical and social expense of being poor. And save one, all of the women you're focusing on in Bad Women are also middle-aged. Can you talk a little bit about the precarious position of working class and poor women in Victorian society, especially as they aged, and how that played a role in their treatment?
Well, women really did not have the same opportunities as men. And one of the things that I actually say in the book is that these working class women were damned almost from birth because their range of possibilities was so limited compared to men of their own class, but also compared to those in other classes as well. And so if you look at, for example, Kate Eddowes and her experiences, and Kate was born into a family of 12 and she was a middle sister. Kate got a better education. Kate was very fortunate because although she was a middle sister, often it was the middle or the younger ones who might go ignored. She was sent to a charity school and she got a slightly better caliber of education. But the reality was that if you were a daughter born into a poor family, you would be the first one pulled out of school to help look after younger children who were sick, to help your mother, to help around the house. So women's education was very spotty and women were hampered by lack of education. And then, of course, you married young and then you started producing children because there was no access to birth control at that time. So you're stuck in this poverty trap. The work that you do is menial. Women's work also was designed to pay a much lower wage than men's work because men were the breadwinners. And if you didn't have a male wage earner, then what do you do if you're a woman with 5 kids, all under the age of 7, 8 maybe, and you have to earn money and you just simply can't. I mean, you then end up in the workhouse, you could end up, you know, you could end up in sex work, you could end up begging, you could end up on the street, just anything could happen. And this is also why if women found themselves abandoned or if their husband died, they would recouple very, very quickly with another man, just any man who could provide. And social reformers at the time talked about how shocking it was that poor women found themselves abandoned and then within, like, sometimes a day could find another man. And that man would suddenly move in and she would be washing his clothes and making his food and he would be sharing his wage with her and her kids. And then she would have children by another man. And then, of course, she was stigmatized at that point as well. Women found it very hard to get out of these circumstances. The only route out really was domestic service, where there was a very clear progress up the ladder. So you could work from being a kitchen maid to the upstairs and, you know, possibly be a housekeeper or something like that, and then retire with some money under your belt. But there was no other way out. You were absolutely stuck. You were damned, especially without birth control.
I would love to hear about the process of turning the 5 into bad women. When did that start? What did you want to include in the podcast that wasn't in the book, and vice versa? Was there anything in the book that didn't feel like a good fit for the podcast?
So it was actually about a 2-year commissioning process that took a very long time to actually get the idea of this over the line. The interesting thing was, in that time, obviously the conversation around the 5 had moved on and people were thinking about it in other ways. And obviously the conflict I had with the Ripperology community as well really kind of push this story into an entirely new territory. You know, the pushback to this book is a story in itself. So I think that was a really important thing to explore in the podcast, which obviously we couldn't do in the book, but also drawing direct comparisons to cases today, such as the Samuel Little case, which we cover, looking at the treatment of women and looking at addiction, for example. How do a lot of the experiences in The Five compare to things that are happening today? A little bit later in the podcast, we're going to be actually looking at how this material is taught in schools in the United Kingdom. Believe it or not, a lot of people do teach units on Jack the Ripper in order to explore things like crime and punishment. And so we're going to be looking at that. I think, you know, in many cases, what we're doing with bad women is incorporating the conversation around the book and incorporating modern issues as well, taking it into the present day. And I think that's quite chilling, because we're talking about social problems that really are still with us, that haven't gone away.
Can we look forward to any other projects based on your research into The Five Women? Are you interested in digging into similar projects where you might center victims who've been marginalized in what should have been their own stories?
Yes, in fact, the book that I'm writing next is an exploration of the murder of Belle Elmore by a man called Dr. H.H. Crippen. And the murder is very famous in the UK. It's surprisingly not as famous in the US, considering that both Crippen and his wife, Belle, were both Americans who had lived in the United States, had spent the majority of their lives in the United States, and moved to London around about the turn of the century. She worked in the music hall. He was a homeopathist. His first wife died under very mysterious circumstances in Salt Lake City, and I've investigated that. So I'm looking at their lives, and more particularly the lives of the women whose stories intersect with his. Because if you tell the stories through their perspective, you see something entirely different. Now, what really I think is fascinating about this is that Belle Elmore, throughout the 20th century, she was murdered in 1910, was kind of blamed for her own murder, because she was described by the man who killed her as being very forceful, very unfeminine in many ways. She was a very strong woman. She's a pretty incredible woman, actually. And it was believed, oh, she was a harridan, you know, and there's a bit of anti-Americanism in this as well, by the British press and by the legal establishment and by authors who are writing about her subsequently, you know, so that she has been demonized completely to the point that by the 1940s, when this story is being recalled, there are authors who are actually writing, if ever a woman deserved to be murdered, it was Belle Elmore. So I'm going to dig into that. And how did we get to the point where we are blaming a woman who stands up for herself, who is quite independent? I mean, she earned her own income. She led her own life apart from her husband, who was a very weak man. How did she become blamed for her own murder? And, you know, what does this say about the way we look at strong women and femicide today? I find that true crime is fascinating because it's a way of taking like a snapshot of a moment in time in the past. And you can gauge where society was, what they were doing, what people were interested in, what were the sets of beliefs and practices, ideologies, what were the systems that were in place, and how did those create the murderer and create the victim? All of these little peripheral stories all add into the tributaries of a river. You know, they all inform the main story. And we can't ignore these things, and we have been ignoring these things.
Thanks for listening. To learn more about The Five and Bad Women, The Ripper Retold, check out the links in our show notes.
You can also find Hallie on Twitter and learn more about her other projects on her website. If you know of a case that should be covered on the Fall Line, there's a link to our case submission form in the show notes. The Fall Line is a fully independent show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIA, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to fund the Milberg Twins billboard and to build a therapy fund for families who've been on the show. Each and every one of our patrons helps us continue this work, and we're so grateful for your help. On Patreon, you can get early release, ad-free versions of our regular episodes, plus blogs and videos for only $5 a month. We've also added video live streams, which all patrons can enjoy, starting at just a dollar. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Warders, Kim Fritz, and Kiana Burgess. Interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd. Currently, our monthly donation is going to Private Investigations for the Missing. Please join us in supporting this nonprofit. They need funds to help families access the services of PIs.